Good afternoon. I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance and Policy Committee to order. Thank you, members. Thank you, public. It's nice to see a full room for a full hearing today with six bills up. First, I'm going to go to Vice Chair Agbaje for approval of the minutes. Would you move the minutes, Vice Chair?
Yes, so moved, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? The minutes are approved. Members, our first bill up is House File 2415, Representative Noor's bill. Representative Noor, welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 2415 be re-referred to the House Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee and go to you, Representative Noor, to present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chen. Members, good afternoon. And this bill, Mr. Chair, members, it's something that I think we've been talking about for a long time. Just seeing the room here today with the Public Housing Executive Director, Abdi Warsami, who was with me on that day, and also seeing the mayor of Minneapolis here, Jacob Fry, who responded on a tragic day on November 27, 2019. When we had a fire in a high-rise building, 25-story high-rise building. When the fire broke out on the 14th floor, fortunately, we lost more than five individuals, and another one passed away thereafter. What happened after that, we introduced a bill that required all public housing to have sprinklers, but we didn't include any other high-rise building. Members, today we're talking about saving lives. When we were on site on that day, you could see the firefighters carrying heavy stuff. While people were trying to come down, they were saving lives. Unfortunately, one of the firefighters was injured on that day. Members, automatic fire sprinklers saves lives. Particularly when there's fire, you need three things. You need firefighters, you need fire alarm, and you also need fire sprinklers to be installed. Thank goodness Minneapolis Public Housing, they have now have a plan to retrofit all their public housing with the funding that they needed actually to do more than just a sprinkler. We didn't give them the funding, we just gave them the law that they have to follow. And I appreciate what the city did, what the public housing did, knowing that their maintenance, that is up to $310 million unfunded maintenance for the city of Minneapolis, they put the priority in putting sprinklers in all the buildings. What this bill does is it provides $10 million grant program, particularly $4 million for the sewer towers, sewer east and west, which I used to represent. Unfortunately, that redistricting took that one away from me. Those are high-rise buildings, 25 floors, with no sprinklers at all. Those are managed by Common Bonds, which is a non-profit entity. So this bill will carve out $4 million so we can finally install fire sprinklers in all those buildings. So this bill is designed for buildings that are higher than 75 feet, whereby the ladder for the firefighters cannot reach, so we're providing them the opportunity to retrofit for all the nonprofits. And this bill, Mr. Chen, members, will save lives. And I'm asking for you to support. I have testifiers who will walk us through the bill.
Thank you, Representative Noor. We're going to go to public testimony. I'm going to comment on this for all bills going forward. We do have a crunched timeline today with the bills before us and want to make sure we get through all the bills. And so I am asking that testifiers keep their comments to 2 minutes. My committee administrator, Mr. Koppel here, will have a timer that you'll hear probably go off if you get near the end, and that's just a signal to kind of to finish your thought and wrap up. And that should help us get through all the bills and all the testimony on the important bills we have before us today. And so up first we have Tom Brace. Mr. Brace, welcome to the committee.
Tom Brace. I'm the former Minnesota State Fire Marshal from 1987 to 2003. Prior to that, I was the Washington State Fire Marshal for 10 years. I'd like to thank Representative Knorr for his leadership in making high-rise housing safer with this bill, as well as previous efforts after the November 27, 2019 fire that broke out on the 14th floor of the Cedar High Apartments. It is widely recognized that those deaths could have been prevented if the building had been sprinkled. In addition to public housing, there are additional high-rise residential buildings built before the 79 Uniform Building Code went into effect in late 1980. Our goal is to provide fire safety whether you live in an old high-rise or a new high-rise, whether it's public housing or not. Residents should have safety in their homes, particularly on floors where the fire truck ladders and hoses cannot reach and there's no easy escape. Many residents living in high-rise residential buildings have mobility issues. The bill provides funding for grants as an incentive rather than a mandate to retrofit fire sprinklers to high-rise residential buildings. The grants will provide a significant contribution to the cost of this valuable public safety tool. The reporting requirements from the cities to the state fire marshal is critical to inform the state as to the number of unsprinklered high-rise buildings. Great effort has been made by the League of Cities, the State Fire Marshal, and the National Fire Sprinkler Association, particularly former Fire Chief Tim Butler, to create a survey. Quickly, the results were found 635 buildings, 18 unsprinklered high-rise buildings, 56 partially sprinkled, and 65 for which we could not find meaningful information on as of yet. I'd like to turn my time over to Minneapolis Fire Chief Brian Tyner to provide his perspective, but first want to call to your attention in your packets letters from the Minnesota Fire Association Coalition and the Multi-Housing Association in your packet. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next up, Chief Tyner. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the esteemed committee. You know, the Cedar Avenue high-rise fire that we're talking about is really just the latest example of a tragedy of this sort in an unsprinklered high-rise building. Unfortunately, local, national, and international history is really rife with these types of tragedies in unsprinklered high-rise buildings. The density of the residents in a high-rise building, the amount of floors that we have to contend with, makes the fighting of a fire in these types of buildings much more complex. And also, they're very labor intensive. Everything that we need to fight the fire, from the 70 pounds of equipment that we wear, to the hoses, to extra air bottles, the tools we need, everything that we need to fight that fire has to be manually carried up to the floor of the fire. And that's even before we start expending the energy to actually fight the fire. So time is of the essence, but also having sprinkler systems assist us exponentially in that they control the fire to the area of origin. And so it makes it safer for the residents, but it also selfishly makes it safer for us as firefighters to fight those types of fires. The good news is, though, is that history is also full of examples of automatic fire sprinkler systems in high-rise buildings that have controlled those fires to the area of origin and have saved lives. Now, unfortunately, we don't see those examples in the news because they're kind of non-incidents. But more often than not, when we have a high-rise fire, that is the case. If it has an automatic sprinkler system, that fire is quickly either put out or controlled in the area of origin. We're able to put it out very quickly without very much smoke spreading, and it saves lives. So today I ask you to support House File 2415 and pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Tyner. Next, we have John Nisja, the Minnesota chapter of the National Fire Sprinklers Association.
He is unable to attend today, sir, but we have
thank you. David Ybarra, you're up, president of the Minnesota Pipe Traders Association. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Howard, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Ibarra. I am president of the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association, an umbrella organization representing more than 9,000 men and women working in the plumbing, pipe fitting, and sprinkler fitter industries. Also share with you that I'm a licensed sprinkler fitter in the state of Minnesota. I have been carrying my license for more than 30 years. The Minnesota Pipe Trades Association is proud to support House File 2415 and respectfully ask that all members of the Committee on Housing and Homelessness Prevention join in passing this vital public safety legislation. This bill is similar to legislation introduced previously in response to the tragic high-rise fire that killed five Minnesotans in November 2019. The State Fire Marshal Office has testified that since 2004, there have been 65 fires in Minnesota that started on or above the seventh floor of a building, the vast majority of them being multifamily high-rise dwellings. In cases where automatic fire suppression sprinklers were present, all fires were quickly contained and or extinguished. Conversely, the fire marshal has concluded that the lack of automatic sprinkler system in the apartment where the fire originated in November was a major factor in the deaths that occurred. State Fire Marshal Division reported on the Minneapolis high-rise fire and concluded, it is the State Fire Marshal Division's position that all high-rise buildings should be protected with fire sprinkler system. Had this building been protected with fire sprinklers, it is the opinion of the State Fire Marshal's office that no loss of life would have occurred. In short, it is universal opinion of firefighting professionals that automatic fire suppression systems in high-rise buildings save lives. It should also be noted that these types of fires are especially dangerous for first responders who are tasked with fighting these types of fires. Carrying firefighting equipment up numerous flights of stairs into flame and smoke is a firefighter's nightmare. While HF 2415 does not require the installation of fire suppression systems, the proposed grant program may very well be enough for a property owner to retrofit their property with one. This is a tremendous benefit for the residents of the property as well as the firefighting professionals tasked with battling these fires. We are pleased to join with our public safety partners in supporting this bill. These tragic deaths are avoidable. Installing fire suppression systems is the best way to achieve that. Thank you.
Thank you. That is the last testifier that signed up. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I've got residents from Seward who wanted to briefly testify.
Hello, thank you. Please state your name for the record and share your testimony with us.
I'm Diane Anders, and thank you for this opportunity. I serve as president of the board of Seward Towers Corporation. Together with Common Bond, we're the managing partners of the Seward Towers, and I want to speak to you about the importance of sprinkling these buildings in particular. I'm proud to chair this board that involves residents, including one of our residents here, Mr. Belay, who came to talk to. And we work hard with other community members to make the Seward Towers a treasured part of our neighborhood and a literal and figurative community asset. Residents of the Seward Towers are neighbors and stakeholders in the Seward neighborhood, and most residents have lived at Seward for many years. The towers are each 21 stories high with a total of 640 apartment homes. These homes are deeply affordable to each family thanks to Section 8 rental insurance that adjusts resident rent payments according to their specific incomes. This is critical as the average household income of residents is only $19,850 annually. Approximately 1,000 people call Seward Towers home at any given time. It's critical that this legislation gets passed now, so that residents of Seward Towers and all of us who care about them as neighbors can sleep soundly, knowing that they and the residents of other buildings under this program have improved fire protection in place. Thank you, Representative Noor, for carrying this bill, and we want to thank Senator Dietzick for also supporting this bill, and thank the committee for your consideration.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and share your testimony with us.
My name is Tariku Balai. I'm an active member of the Seward Tower Corporation Board of Directors. I also call Seward Tower West is my home. Many of my neighbors are extremely vulnerable. The Seward Towers provide home to nearly 400 seniors, over 200 children and nearly 225 people who have disability. I hate to imagine what might happen in the event of a major fire. We have seen the devastation, the tragic and unnecessary deaths in other high-rise properties from fires that would have likely been quickly snuffed out had those buildings been sprinkled. Please help us make our homes safer places. We have worked hard to save enough money from our rents to make the required match under this bill, and with the help of our management team, we are ready to go. We cannot, we should not wait. Your support of this bill will not only help ensure the safety of me and nearly 1,000 neighbors, but many more with these important new programs. Thank you for your kind of consideration.
Thank you for joining us. Thanks for your testimony. We'll proceed to member discussion. Representative Dodseth.
Thank you, Chair Howard and Representative. The question I've got is, I think we all value the importance of a program like this. The question I have is, I noticed that on lines 1.17 through 1.21, it references that priority shall be given to nonprofit applicants. And that the 25% match for the nonprofits and a 50% match for for-profit. Is there a reasoning for the discrepancy of separating the two? I would think that all properties should be equal on this. Is there a reasoning for that?
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chen, members. I think the nonprofit high-rise buildings, the ones which we have identified, and that the ones who technically they've been asking us to support them with additional funds, those who are in the regular market rates, particularly have already installed sprinklers. So this is more geared towards more nonprofit managed buildings and owned buildings so that they can retrofit. So we're giving them more high priority than the regular owners who may have the wherewithal to do the retrofitting.
Representative Dodson?
I guess the question would be, would you consider maybe amending it and having it where it's equal across the board for profit and nonprofit? I think it's something that would be reasonable. I think I could look at getting on board on this.
Representative Noor.
Mr. Chair, I think there's a need to look into how many buildings, because the second section in the bill, we are asking the fire marshal, the state fire marshal, to receive the data from all the cities. This will help us identify how many more buildings need retrofitting. Quite frankly, because of the change that happened during the 1990s, I believe, that required all high-rise building to have sprinklers, took care of most of the commercially owned for-profit high-rise building. So this essentially, for those who we underfund, and they provide a great service to the state. They're serving the individuals that you had from the testifier here, disabled individuals, low-income individuals. They may not be able to have the resources needed for those nonprofit entities to do the retrofitting. It's costly, as you can see. For two buildings, it's going to cost more than $4 million.
Thank you.
Representative Hussein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mahmoud, for bringing this forward. I remember November 27, 2019 was very devastated day for our community when we lost family members, friends, and the people that I know were very close to us. If we would have had the sprinklers and well-equipped, we could have saved people's life. This is a very important bill, and thank you for bringing it forward. Those high-rises that you look at and see the Riverside, the people that are living in there is vulnerable, senior citizen, disabled, and they cannot take those stairs. And I believe if we will put those equipments that are necessary that they need for sprinklers, could save life, and those five individuals that we lost in that day could be here with us. This is very important, Bill, and I'm not only saying that we should have a sprinklers in Minneapolis, but also the rest of the other states, because we could save humans' life and people's life. And Mahmoud, Chair Mahmoud, Representative, thanks for bringing this bill forward. And I would urge all my colleagues to support this bill. because this is a human, and we want to talk about life and save.
Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Noor, for this bill. I have a comment and then a question. Let me start with the comment. This is a really important bill. When we talk about high-rises, we also have to talk about who lives in these high-rises, who are the individuals that are living in this, occupying this space. Some of these are families with small children. I have, you know, relatives and people I know that live in high-rises, and I have I'm claustrophobic, so I'm very afraid of heights. So every time I am in these buildings, I'm like, I'm worried about the, in case of fire, how do I get down? And imagine, you know, living there every day and worrying about, like, in case of fire, I'm on the 25th floor, I may be disabled, I may have four young children, I may be a senior citizen who have, you know, existing health conditions, asthma, whatever you name it. How do I get down to the ground floor in case of fire? It's, you know, it's a hazard, and I don't even know how we went up to this day that there are buildings that high that don't have fire sprinklers. I don't know how's that's possible, but then we keep learning something new every day, and that's the dilemma that's in front of us. But I support this bill. And I thank you for the work that you have done ever since that day, that really dark day in November of 2019. I remember that day. It was a cold day, and we were all gathered in front of that 610, was it 610 or 620? Can't remember. Building. And the amount of, you know, fear and uncertainty in some of our neighbors' minds, and it was a building that was predominantly occupied by elders that had the fire. So I support this bill, and I'm super thankful for your work around this. But my question was, it says that $4 million of this grant goes to Common Bond, and then there's the two buildings mentioned in here. Is it going to cost $4 million for this specific two buildings to get fire sprinklers?
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Hassan, I think if you look at the cost, we have been informed it's going to cost more than $3,000 to $4,000 just to retrofit unit. At the same time, the residents have to be moved from one place to the other. So the process of transition plus the cost of the retrofitting is going to be more significant. As you can see in the bill, there's also a requirement for 25% share for the cost that will be incurred during that process. So I think this is just a small amount compared to the need that we see out there.
Mr. Chair,
Hassan, yeah.
Allow me one more follow-up. And I'm not, like, questioning, you know, the amount being high, but what I'm questioning is I also have many high-rises in my district, and I know that, you know, some of them are occupied by seniors only, and I'm, like, trying to calculate in my head how much it's going to cost us to get out of this mess. But thank you very much for your work, and I'm supporting the bill, and I hope members can support, because we cannot put a price on human life, and this is a tool to save people's lives. Thank you.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is just a technical question for Chair Noor. On line 1.16, I looked at the statute 299M-01. The sprinkler system that's defined there is for the potable waters type system, and I'm aware that there are other fire suppression programs out there. Would those qualify, or is this strictly limited to only just the water system?
Representative Noor.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to phone a friend, maybe check in with non-partisan staff or Mr. Brace.
A lot of people just kind of giving each other that eye. Is it you? Mr. Ybarra, looks like you draw the short straw. So I appreciate. Thank you.
I think the books are behind you. Yeah.
Again, I would speculate, and again, this is purely conjecture. David Ybarra, Minnesota Pipe Trades Association. I would gather that this is probably the most affordable way to install this type of system, because I would venture to guess that These buildings already have standpipes in the stairwells for the firefighters to hook up their hoses to. So what they'll do, assuming they'll have to do a hydraulic calculation to make sure there's ample water, maybe add a fire pump or two, but you'll be able to install floor control valves and that. So that will be, given the fact that there's already some equipment in the building, this is the most affordable way to install these systems. But there are some chemical suppression systems, yes. Primarily those are installed in like kitchen applications, cooking, not so much in the housing sector.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. And that's kind of what I expect, too. It probably deals with the economy of it, but we're making changes all the time. And so I wasn't sure if moving into the future, if there might be some other options that might be available. Sounds like right now it's just a water system. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Chairman. And thank you, Chair Noor. I also want to give a special greeting to Chief Tyner. I grew up with his daughter, and it's good to see family in these spaces. And that are responding with this bill as a responding to tragedy, responding to a day that is very difficult for our communities, especially a staple in our East African community in what I like to call the hippie grassroots rock and roll movement of Cedar Riverside, because those are our community spaces of village. And this bill, you know, it's a token of action in response to tragedy. You know, we think about when the bridge fell in 2008, our state responded and is still responding in the infrastructure. This is a step of response, because if you think about the architect of that, the buildings that surround and that community that was built into these apartments, late 60s, early 70s, it just stirs in my mind how many more housing developments are in need of these systems. And this is an opportunity of opening a door for those studies. I'm sure you have the experts here, but also an opportunity to respond to the community in showcasing and honoring those lives that have died through taking action. You know, we always say, can we hold a moment of silence? But can we hold moments to build the movements of making sure that these buildings and these houses to, you know, some of the most newest families and some of the most celebrated families that are in those spaces that deserve to honor the community with taking action and not just moments of silence and names of remembrance written down. And I feel that, Representative Chair Noor, this is a way of response to tragedy, and this is a form of justice in community housing.
Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Noor. I'm going to piggyback a little bit off what Representative Hassan was talking about, and one of the questions I had was, you know, is that $4 million going to cover these two structures? So I guess where I will go is this, you know, do we know right now from the information you have how many other buildings this would impact? And I know there was some statistics given, so.
Representative Noor or Mr. Bryce?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Myers. I think the question is, if we look at Minneapolis Public Housing, they invested their own resources and also the city of Minneapolis to support them so they can retrofit all the high-rise buildings. All high-rise buildings in St. Paul, they were smart enough to retrofit all their buildings prior to that. And we're trying to also collect the data through the state fire marshal. This work is, we're not done. At least we have to keep on coming until we retrofit all the high-rise buildings in the state of Minnesota. So this is just a small amount of resource that is needed now so we can start doing the work. And if we find out there are more buildings, it's our obligation to make sure that we fully fund retrofitting all the high-rise buildings in the state.
Mr. Myers?
Yeah, and I was trying to, you know, and I appreciate that, you know, I'm trying to get in my own head where the, you know, it's going to be a much bigger dollar number in the future, but I'm interested to know if somebody with that $6 million that's remaining there, you know, what kind of impact can that have?
Mr. Brace?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we thought that it's a beginning. It's a twofold attack, if I can use a rather strong word. We're going to learn from the retrofit of the sewer building. 640 units in there. That's a major, major, 21 floors high, stories high. That's a major effort. We're going to learn a lot about the retrofit costs, I mentioned in my testimony that we've identified so far 18 unsprinkled buildings throughout the state of Minnesota, to the point about not just Minneapolis. 56 partially, that will be cheaper because it's some of the systems, the standpipes that was mentioned by David Yavara, it would be able to be used. But we have 65 that we still need to find some data about. So hence the need for the state fire marshal to have a reporting mechanism, which the bill outlines, so that we'll be able to more inform you. But it's a start. And it's an important start, we should be able to be in a position to give you even more information in the future, and also learn from this experience.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate that. I appreciate Chair Knorr taking on these two buildings and understanding a better idea of how many buildings are going to be impacted. And so, when you come back, I think learning a lot about what's going to be done, getting an inventory is important. As of right now, have there been any other public or private buildings that have come to you besides these two that are willing to jump on fairly quickly?
Representative Knorr?
Mr. Chair, Representative Myers, I haven't heard back from any other, group or individuals, because I know very well the two high-rise buildings in Seward. If they are, I think they'll be responding to us immediately once they hear that we're talking about.
Yes.
Mr. Brace.
Representative, this you could look at as maybe a pilot program, and as the word gets out, I think we'll help fill out our data from people that we didn't know that apply.
Yeah.
Wanted to apply and get a part of it.
Yeah, I just think it's important, that education piece, to get it out into the public so that, we learn a lot from these two projects, but, there is money there to, as people said, we need to move quickly in these situations, and if there's money out there to retrofit those, letting those, buildings know and the people know that this option is out there is important.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Nord. I understand why you bring this forward. I think it's a good idea. But I think it would be a better idea if we went to equal amounts, both public and privately owned facilities. We want everybody to be safe. When you start making the privately owned pay more compared to the publicly owned, you're driving up costs for those who might not want to live in a publicly owned and want to live in a privately owned facility. But you're pricing them out of doing that because you're giving an unfair advantage to nonprofits who owns a lot of these facilities. I take it the reason this is going to common bond communities because they are the owners of those towers. Am I speculating correctly?
Representative Knorr?
Mr. Chair, Lee Johnson, I think the ownership is complicated a little bit. The common bonds is the management entity that is responsible for taking care of those buildings in Seward.
Representative Johnson.
Okay, if it's for a management company, they have a lot of assets, $172 million by their latest 990. I think if a lot of I know the privately owned ones in my area don't have that much money. I guess I'd like to know, and they have a net assets available right now of us by the latest 990 of over $75 million, which is a good chunk of change. So I think it's important that we treat everybody the same, because, like I say, it's an unfair advantage. Just because somebody privately owns something, they have to pay more for the same thing that's publicly owned. And do I think it's important to get those sprinkles or the fire suppression systems? Absolutely. I was a firefighter. I had to go talk to my senior housing developments in the apartment complex. Granted, it was only a three-story. And one of the questions that I was asked, because I was there as a firefighter, what happens if there's a fire? Should we help get our neighbors out? And I had to tell them, no, make sure their doors are closed, but unlocked if possible. So when the fire department get there, we can help get them out because we have the gear and the equipment to do it. And yes, those fire hoses are heavy, but generally in a high rise, a firefighter will use the elevator when available to get closer to the floor so they don't have to carry it up 20 floors. Because by the time you got to the 24, that firefighter would be worthless. He'd use up his tank of air to get up there. So I'm in favor of this idea, but we have to figure out the cost. And when you first brought this bill forward, I did explain it was a whole lot more expensive than you were talking about at the time. And I think we're still at the 16 or 17, I guess it's now it's 18 buildings that you originally talked about in 2018. But, and I think that was at that time they were talking the entire state. Now we're finding a few more. So I guess I would like to if we can, get it opened up to competitive bidding across the state, because we have some all over the state that we need to be taken care of as well. So, well, thank you for bringing this forward, and I hope you consider what I brought forward.
Representative Neuer, we'll go to you for final comments, and I'll thank you for your continued work on this bill this session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a good bill, and I'll end with that. I ask for your support. I'm more open to having conversation with Lee Johnson and others who have voice the concerns, and we'll make sure that we've got a good bill by the end of session. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I will renew the motion that House Bill 2415 be re-referred to the House Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails, and you're on your way to Public Safety, Representative Noor. Up next, we have House File 2477 from Vice Chair Igbaje, Minnesota Public Housing. Vice Chair Igbaje, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the bill.
Vice Chair moves her bill. The motion will be to lay this over for possible inclusion. Vice Chair Igbaje, please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Howard and members of the committee. Today I'm presenting House File 2477, which is a request for $45 million from the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority. These funds will support the critical repair needs of more than 700 deeply affordable family homes. The funding here will support more than 3,100 residents in single-family, duplex, and triplex-style homes, where 80% of these residents are families with children. Of the residents who call these properties home, nearly 87% are black, 85% are women-led, and two-thirds or more have five or more people living in the home. By providing stability in housing, people can find jobs that better provide better incomes and begin the process of saving to support their families. Public housing can also help people move on into home ownership. MPHA has seen some of these results when between 2020 and 2022, an estimated 17% of families moved from public housing to buy their own home. In order to preserve public housing in Minneapolis and support improved stability for these families, we need to overcome the backlog that MPHA has for these houses. The federal government has not been forthcoming on its responsibility to fund public housing, which is why we at the state and local level are working together to bridge those gaps. Because public housing is funded and operated in multi-jurisdictional structures, all policymakers at every level of government have an obligation to fully use all of the tools available to take bold action and address the systemic problem. That's why I'm glad we'll hear from state and local colleagues in this fight for public housing to discuss the need and what an investment of $45 million can do for the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority. And with that, I'll move to testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. First on my list is Councilmember Robin Wansley. Councilmember, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Robin Wunsley, and I represent Ward 2 on the Minneapolis City Council. I'm here today to support the proposed $45 million allocation to the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority. I have always been a champion of public housing, and I do so because I see every day in my role the disastrous impacts of investing in for-profit-only housing models. I see working-class people struggling with unaffordable rents. I also see unsheltered residents face brutal evictions regularly from a city that refuses to house them. There is no solution to our housing crisis without public housing. As elected leaders, we have a responsibility to ensure safe, stable, and affordable housing for everyone. And that responsibility must also include fully investing in our public housing system. This $45 million is a crucial piece of funding because it enables the entire CHR portfolio to become financially self-sustaining in perpetuity. That's particularly important because this repair has been used to privatize public housing. Therefore, this funding will help ensure that our public housing will remain not only publicly available, but permanently affordable. The scatter sites are also incredibly valuable because they accommodate larger families and are mixed into residential neighborhoods. This contributes so much to the strengthening of our social fabric in our city and combating decades of discriminatory housing policy. By ensuring that the CHR portfolio is covered with this allocation, it will also free up revenue that we hope to generate through a public housing levy for other incredibly, you know, crucial investments like repairs for Section 9 properties and expanding the overall stock of public housing. At the end of the last year, and I was really excited to hear Representative Norris' bill around fire suppressions because I led the City Council in allocating $1.2 million to ensure that every public housing tower does have fire sprinklers. Now I plan to work with my colleagues and lead the council to pass a public housing levy this year to ensure there is a long-term commitment of funding from the city for our public housing. Committee, you have willing and enthusiastic partners on the City Council like myself who are ready to continue working in partnership with you all to make sure that quality housing, public housing, is given to every single resident. Because they deserve that, so thank you so much today.
Thank you. Next, we have Sam Priest-Stinson, Commissioner, Board of Estimate and Taxation. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chairman and committee members. My name is Samantha Priest-Stinson, and I am the president of the Minneapolis Board of Estimate and Taxation, and I am here in today in support of funding public housing. Residents of these properties what I want to say is that there's vulnerable and marginalized communities that desperately need this housing. And this year in Minneapolis, we increased the property taxes, which placed an undue burden on those particular residents, which happened to be in wards 4 and 5. And we know that we can't keep taxing our way out of this situation. We're working at a deficit with where public housing is. And while we do need to dedicate those funds, we also need the assistance. That's why I'm so excited about having this intergovernmental support to fund this and not just put it on the backs of people that are paying their property taxes and then rent out those properties, especially in those particular areas. It's causing an undue burden, and we're asking more of people that have less as a result. The funding will allow for MPHA's CHR scattered sites portfolio to become financially self-sustaining, which is great. That's particularly important because disrepair is used as a pretext for privatization. And with this funding, there's no more legitimate reason or pretext to ever privatize the scattered site portfolio. The levy funding, along with the funding from the state, will allow for us to bridge the widening gap so that the work that I'm leading at the Board of Estimate and Taxation can sustain the gains that this funding is projected to make. Over 5,000 families in Minneapolis are waiting. just to get into housing. And public housing is one of the only housing that we have to meet the need of those that are at 30% or below of AMI. The data showing the impact of this housing on the overall economic stability of families is extremely positive, with a high proportion of families able to gain economic stability and buy their own homes. First-time home buying power in the Black community, for example, has fallen below 20%, which is lower than during the civil rights era. And they make up a large amount of folks that are in public housing and are in need of public housing. I say that as a veteran who, luckily, I had access to be able to buy my home. I've been a homeowner for 3 years, but that might not be the case. And my family lived in public housing when I was young, and so I'm a product of what can happen when we fund our people and make these wise investments. I would also be remiss if I didn't mention our unhoused neighbors, who without access to housing, especially in the public sector, are likely to remain outside. And we cannot continue to kick the can down the road. I'm very thankful that we are working intergovernmentally on this issue and making this commitment. Governor Walz often mentions that we measure what we value. And this is an investment that is measurable, and it demonstrates that we value our community members and their futures. Housing is an ecosystem, and public housing is part of that. It is a foundation for stability and a pathway to generational wealth building, like homeownership. Thank you for your time and consideration today.
Thank you. Next, we have Abdi Warsami, the Executive Director of Minnesota, Minneapolis Public Housing Authority. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Howard, and thank you, members of the committee, for welcoming me to share more about MPHA and how we would deploy this historic investment. Currently, the agency, I apologize, my name is Abdi Warsami, I'm the CEO and Executive Director of the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority. So my apologies. Currently, the agency, or MPHA, maintains a major capital backlog for its deeply affordable family homes because of decades of de-investment from the federal government while these homes were in the agency's public housing portfolio. In 2020, we converted these homes to operate on the Section 8 platform through the agency's wholly owned and controlled nonprofit Community Housing Resources, or CHR. Through this conversion, we were able to more than double, so more than 2.5% of the federal subsidy that we used to receive when we were in the Section 9 or public housing. This is important because it allows the agency to invest more money back into this portfolio, but it's not enough to overcome the capital backlog. So we can put money into it, but we're still swimming against the tide. In fact, absent a large outside capital infusion, the continued operability of these homes are in jeopardy. With a one-time $45 million cash investment from the state, we believe that this portfolio can become self-sustainable and self-sufficient. MPHA has a full capital deployment plan for the entire portfolio, and with these funds from the state, the agency can scale up and pull forward that plan over the next 10 years. We know we can do this because last year, Mayor Fry championed the $3.7 million investment from the city's 2023 budget to help MPHA do this work. We were able to quickly accommodate that new funding into our work the same way we would be with this funding. And this funding would do more than just stabilize these homes for thousands of families over the next 30 years. This bill will make more homes ADA accessible. It will deliver greater home energy efficiencies, and it will invest in minority-owned, women-owned, and low-income Section 3 businesses. In the last 18 months, MPHA has awarded 24% of the contracts for this type of capital improvement work to minority-owned businesses, 17% to women-owned businesses, and 29% to low-income Section 3 businesses. I cannot overstate how transformative this investment will be for the 3,100 residents living in these homes today and for the estimated 3,800 families who would live in these homes over the next 30 years and for our entire region. This will be a life-changing moment for MPHA families. And again, let's think about the people who live there. These are predominantly children, Black children, led by Black female head of households, 87% of them. And these units, we know, have provided stability for these families. These families stay not forever, but for period of 5 to 6 years, and they move on to greater pastures. 17% of them we have studied from 2020 to the end of 2022 have moved on to become homeowners. So we know this has an impact on economic mobility, and that's why we chose to come in front of you, because this is the portfolio that has the most impact in all the work that we provide at MPHA. Thank you again for the opportunity to share these details with you. I will now turn over to Minneapolis High-Rise Representative Council. Sorry. So I have two other people who will speak after me. I think Chair Howard will. One of them is Mary McGovern, who is the head of our Residence Council, and another is Mary Vang, who is a colleague of mine who actually lived and grew up in this homes. So thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you for
giving me the opportunity to speak in front of you.
Absolutely. Thank you. We are going to hear from Mary Vang and Mary McGovern. First, we're going to hear from Mayor Jacob Frey. Mayor Frey, welcome to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am honored to be here to testify in favor of House File 2477. This is a critical bill right now for our entire city. I think you're all well-versed at this point. We're talking about $45 million to go into substantial capital backlogs as well as the improvements to a number of scattered site developments around the city. I want to give you a rundown as to why this is so essential, and then I want to also give you a rundown as to the work that is already happening at the City of Minneapolis so you can see how this money would further bolster it. We have about 16 properties, previously 16 units, that we were previously working on at the City of Minneapolis that we were able to expand into 84 units, 64 units then, 84 units now, and countless more around the city. In the scattered site format that are in need of really substantial improvement. On top of those scattered site improvements, we know that there's deferred maintenance in Minneapolis public housing to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. That figure is only going up every single year. It's not as if this issue is getting better. It behooves all of us to tackle this issue right now. Not just from an ideological perspective or a policy one, but from a fiscal perspective. This is smart planning by doing it now. This $45 million is critical and goes on top of really substantial investments that the City of Minneapolis has already made. Just recently, understanding the depth of the issue, we put $5.8 million in cash, $2.1 million in LIHTC or low-income tax credits, and then $25 million in bonds. That was then followed up with an additional $8 million from 2022 to 2023 for the preservation and expansion of some of these deeply affordable housing homes. We have totally shifted the way that we budget for affordable housing in the city of Minneapolis. We are producing five times the amount of deeply affordable, low-income housing that we previously did. We are producing more than any city in our state's history. Still, it is not enough. We owe this to people that live in our public housing stock. We owe this to people who need deeply affordable housing. We feel that this is critical. And this is a topic that we're all in on. It's good fiscal policy. It's good humanitarian policy. I greatly appreciate the work and the opportunity to testify here from Representative Agbaje and the committee members. And thank you for carrying this so important legislation. And I understand there will be questions afterwards. I'm happy to wait until then. I'm also happy to answer them now.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you.
I think we'll go to Ms. Vang and Ms. McGovern, and if there's questions, we'll have you back. Next, we have Mary Vang, Regional Property Manager at Minneapolis Public Housing Authority. Welcome to the committee.
Hello. Chair Howard, members of the committee, thank you for welcoming us today to today's hearing. I'm honored to be here today representing Minneapolis Public Housing Authority and scattered site residents. My name is Mary Vang. I am a regional property manager at MPHA. I've worked for MPHA for 18 years, In my role, I am responsible for maintenance of about 937 public housing units, serving about 1,019 MPHA residents with a staff of 21. Unique to today's hearing, however, is that I am a product of MPHA scattered site housing, the housing portfolio HF2477 would address. My parents arrived in Minnesota in the early 1980s as refugees from Laos during the Vietnam War. Coming to Minnesota with next to nothing, it was an MPHA scattered site home that provided my family a safe, stable roof over our heads. The housing was critical for my family. It allowed my family to live and accomplish the American dream, knowing that there will always be roof over our heads. And because of the stability provided by MPHA scattered site home, my parents were able to work hard and save enough money to purchase their own home only after a few years. Now, decades later, I have a growing career at MPHA, and I am the first Hmong American to hold the regional property manager role. All of this has been made possible by MPHA scattered site homes. My story is just one of many that exemplifies what stable housing through Minneapolis Public Housing Authority can do. Chair Howard, members of the committee, I urge you to include this cash funding to MPHA in your upcoming budget to help thousands of families just like mine for generations to come. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Last, we have Mary McGovern, president of the Minneapolis High-Rise Representative Council.
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Mary McGovern. I'm president of the Minneapolis High-Rise Representative Council, and I represent over 5,000 public housing residents in Minneapolis. We stand in solidarity with our neighbors and family members living in scattered site housing. Can we agree that all people, rich, poor, and in between, want to deserve to live in decent, safe, and well-maintained housing? Unfortunately, low-income folks in our state and cities who depend on publicly supported housing too often do not actually have the experience of living in housing that is safe, decent, and well-maintained. This is largely because of years of under investment and disinvestment by the federal government in housing for our country's most vulnerable and in need. As public housing resident leader, I have heard too often from local and state officials that public housing is not our problem or our responsibility. Well, guess what? The attitude does nothing to help us, and helping the most vulnerable among us is what we expect of elected officials of all levels of government, and what we urgently need. The passage of this bill, this historic one-time investment of $45 million to help the MPHA finally make a real dent in over $200 million backlog of capital needs, would show that you understand the role the state can and should have ensuring all families, all children, truly get to experience decent, safe, and well-maintained housing. You'd want nothing less for your own. With this funding, Minnesota would be leading the way in showing the importance of safe investment and preserving public housing and its commitment to low-income citizens being treated with respect and dignity by local government. I urge you, please support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on the bill? If not, we can go to member discussion. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just quick ask a question of you, Mr. Chair, if I could. $45 million is here, and we're coming to the last 2 weeks of really committee work. And, of course, I'm going to be asking the question, do we have any idea on when we're going to start hearing some targets and what's going to go on with that? And then I have one follow-up.
Representative Petersburg, I anxiously await that news as well. I'm hopeful. You know, it's like one of those, you hear, like, you put your ear against the wall and you're wondering, but I'm hopeful as soon as next week, that we'll have a better sense of that.
All right. Thank you for that. And that, I will just say a final comment, and that is, I think it was the second testifier who talked about when the need for Minneapolis and said, we can't tax our way out of this problem. And, you know, I fully agree with that, and I think that's true of all government. We can't do that. But I wanted to remind us that the $45 million that we're talking about here is taxpayer dollars. And so it is taxing our way out of this problem if we think that's going to be the solution. And I'm just saying, whether the state does it or not, you and I as legislators, we can't provide any funding for anything unless we first take those dollars from somebody else in the form of taxes. And just want to remind us that sometimes we have to figure out how we're going to divvy up that pot. So thank you for my 2 cents worth. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Thank you, Representative Bajaj, for bringing this forward. To the testifier, Mary Vang, congratulations on your position. I just want to highlight a little bit about your journey, as I was also a refugee from the Vietnam War. In the late 75, in 1975, Minnesota decided to take upon a group of refugees from the Vietnam War, which the majority happened to be the Hmong Americans that you see today, which I am a Hmong American, one of 9 Hmong legislators here in the state of Minnesota. The investment that was made into my community in the 70s, in the 80s, where I would tell you that the majority, maybe over 60 to 70% of our family and community was able to have an equal footing because of the investment made into public housing. The McDonough Homes, Monterey, Plaza, Congress, and many others that I have not named. We are a product of public housing, the Hmong community. It has been a challenge for my community and other communities of refugees and immigrants in America to understand the concept of a mortgage and a lease. Because in our homeland, we don't have leases. We don't have property taxes. We don't have mortgages. Just to give you context, as refugees coming to America, we're talking about tenant and lease contracts. I've never seen an airplane or automobile, even a toilet or a stove in 1980 when I came here to St. Paul. Today, I'm a state legislator. That's how far we've come. But I would tell you that at the heart of that journey was that investment in public housing and home secure that was provided to me, my family, that changed the educational and health outcome of my trajectory. And so with that, Abaje, thank you.
Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Vice Chair Agbaje, for this bill. I'm going to echo what Rep. Cha said. Your community went through this in the 80s. My community is going through it now. Many of this, you know, low-income housing have new immigrants from East Africa, from Somalia. And I also want to uplift what one of the testifiers said, safe, stable housing, affordable housing, as well as, you know, respecting people in these spaces. A lot of times what happens is that we disrespect people because they're in low-income housing or they're receiving assistance because of their life circumstances. We live in a capitalist country that respects money too much and doesn't respect human beings that much. So I just want to uplift that this is a really important bill. But I have a question for my mayor, if my mayor would come down. I have a question about the levy, and I want to know if the city is going to, if we're going to have a levy so we can continue having the support that we need. This is, I believe, is a one-time appropriation, so we're still going to need maintenance for this housing, and we know that the federal government has not been providing us the resources that we need. So where are we at with a levy on public housing in the city, and is there going to be one? Thank you.
Mayor Pry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hassan, thank you for the question. So the last several years, we have put additional money into public housing, both one time as well as ongoing. In fact, we've done it more these last couple of years than many of the, probably the previous 10 years combined. And this is work that we need to do. It is work that is going to continue in terms of the investments in public housing directly from the city, both ongoing and one time. Can I give you the specific dollar right now? That would be irresponsible. We still need to work through the budget process. We need, just like you all do, and thank you for your work, need to balance out all of the other priorities that we have. I can tell you that public housing will be a priority. We have convened a group of state, county, municipal, federal, and nonprofit entities. I have brought these individuals together, and the whole goal of this is to find both solutions as well as funding to this public housing equation. As I mentioned before, it's not just about the scattered site that we're here asking you for today. We're asking you for $45 million for scattered site. There's also pretty substantial deferred maintenance on the high rises themselves, as has been stated. We need to be creating more public housing, not simply maintaining the ones that, the units that we already have. And there's a backlog of somewhere in the range of 7,500 people that are on a list waiting for public housing right now as we speak, 7,500 people. So we have a big obligation here. Will the city step up? Absolutely, we will. Can I give you the exact dollar figure right now? No, I cannot. But this needs to be a joint effort with all of us, and that's why we're here today asking for assistance. Thank you.
Can I just
Representative
one more and then I'm done. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, for that answer. All I want to say is that this housing is, you know, occupied predominantly by black children, black families, as is stated. And I just want the same treatment for our black families as other families. I want to make sure that people who are living in low-income housing are not left behind and are not forgotten and that they do get treated as other people are being treated. They're the most vulnerable in our city, in our state, and they need our help, and we must continue to provide that help for them. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative,
yeah, Mayor Frey,
if I could respond. I agree with you entirely, Representative. And it's not just an agreement in words. We have put our money where our mouth is. When I took office, housing was then and is now, probably will always be, a priority of mine. We backed it up, investing three times the previous record in affordable housing. That investment has resulted in producing five times the amount of low-income, deeply affordable housing that we used to create on an annual basis. We're talking about thousands of units of affordable and deeply affordable housing. We would put our work on housing up against any other city in the entire country on a per capita basis. This is work that's important. I agree with you full-heartedly. It's work that needs to continue, and you're entirely right. The vast majority of people in this housing are, of course, low income, but people of color, as you stated. And yes, we're all in on this, and I think we need to be all in on it together, and that's part of my presence here.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Bajie, thank you for bringing this forward. I do have some questions, but first of all, I have a couple questions for Mayor Frey. First of all, Mayor, I want to thank you for coming into the Lion's Den. I know you've been willing to do that before in the past, dealing with law enforcement issues and stuff like that, so I want to thank you for coming today. I do have a couple questions for you. I know in the past, I think on average, the city of Minneapolis has received around $90 million straight from the federal government in HUD dollars. We're hearing rumors that that is going to be cut. Is that the case that's going on that you're hearing as well, that the federal dollars might be cut for the programs that you have?
Mayor Frey?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the HUD dollars are in constant fluctuation. Some of them, like CDBG or Community Development Block Grants funds, are relatively flexible, and so while they may be cut in one area, they perhaps will be added to in others. I recently went out to Washington, D.C., and met with the Deputy Secretary of HUD. We have not received word that dollars are being cut in substantial amounts anyway. That is not the message that we've received. The administration at the federal government has been doubling down on this, and I want to note on this particular topic in terms of public housing, it's been drastically underfunded since probably the 80s. Both Democrat and Republican, there's no real ideological bent here, has underfunded public housing substantially, and this is why this convening has been so important. It's to make sure that we've got all of these entities that are at the table doing their part, their respective parts, to uplift this housing stock. HUD dollars in general, I don't know if we've got any additional information from staff about the cut of HUD. No, we're not aware of any cut.
Representative Johnson.
Mayor Fry, thank you for that information. The other thing I want to ask about, the ask here is for $45 million, and all the supportive documentation is you're about $31 million in backlog. I'm just wondering, is the extra $14 million to try to get ahead of things or something like that?
Mayor Fry? Or Representative Bajay?
I'm going to start by answering a portion of it and probably call on either Representative or perhaps Director Warsami here to give you more of a full rundown. Again, we're talking about scattered site. There's both backlog, but then there's also maximizing the utility of the particular site. So we wanted to go as far as we possibly can with the existing dollars or what allocated dollars we will ultimately get. As I mentioned, what we've managed to do is transition 16 parcels into 84 units. So 16 units before, 84 units now. There are many other parcels throughout the city where we could be getting more bang for our buck by having additional units to tackle some of that 7,500 person backlog that we have in terms of those waiting on a long list. So this is about maintenance. This is about creation of new as well, because we at the city will have money going towards that. And then ultimately, and this is not part of the ask today, the backlog is well in extent of $45 million. We're talking about several hundred million dollars in deferred maintenance that needs to be tackled.
I'll go to either Vice Chair Bajay or Director Warsami if you have further. Yep.
Chair Howard, Representative Johnson. The answer to your question is we're going to try to deploy this money over 10 years, and in 10 years, this kind of compounds. So while it's $31 million today, we envisage we need $45 million to kind of carry it to the 10 years. And also, this is one-time funding, because what we did is we did the conversion from Section 9 to Section 8, and that has increased the subsidy that we get. It's a lot more stable subsidy that comes in Section 8, because it has both public and private landlords that take Section 8 vouchers, and that has increased the money that's coming in. However, if we don't take care of the capital backlog, we will be in, you know, we might lose these properties in 10 years. So what this does is one-time funding. It allows us to keep this portfolio sustainable, so we don't come back here or come back to the city and ask for that money. It allows us to be sustainable, and it allows us to then build reserves, just like you would with any, you know, normal housing. Well, the public housing did not allow us to build reserves.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you for that information. One last thing. I'm just wondering why Community Housing Resources was named in this for receiving these funds. I pulled up the 990s. I'm not sure if they haven't been filed for a number of years, or they just haven't been, at the federal level, haven't been put in place, but every other place I can get up to, I can get 2021s, but the most current one for Community Housing Resources is 2018. And I went back prior to them as well, and it's always the same saying on the bottom of it. Community Housing Resources is intended to be a supporting and ultimately provide an outside source of revenue for the authority public housing activities. There hasn't been any activity to provide low-income solutions in a few years. However, the Community Housing Resource is always looking for opportunities to provide affordable housing for low-income residents. And going back through every 990, I can't find that they've done anything. Except for the initial amount of funds put into an account for them, all they've ever had was interest. I'm just wondering if their plan has changed, and now that they want $45 million, which would be a 1,200% increase in their level of funding, since they only have $38,000 in their account right now.
Chair Howard,
I'm just wondering why that particular nonprofit was put in here as listing as being the one, the way I read it, is mainly going to be getting the funding.
Mr. Orsami.
Yeah. Chair Howard, Representative Johnson, I like the way you did your homework, but it's not as accurate as you think it was. The Community House Resources, CHR, is an affiliate of MPHA. So it's just a wing of MPHA, the same board as the board. I'm the president of it. And the conversion was done in 2020. So, you know, now it's not $38,000 in there. It's millions of dollars that it oversees. It is a wing of MPHA. It's the same board. It's our nonprofit, wholly owned, wholly controlled. And the reason why we chose it is because those family housing portfolio, the 800 units that we're talking about, 700 plus units that we're talking about, and the 3,100 individuals that we're talking about live under CHR today. So it's not a nonprofit that has $38,000. It's an actual nonprofit that is working, that has over 60 staff working there, and we do have that information, and we can provide that to you, sir.
Representative Johnson, if you can.
I want to thank for that information. Like I said, you might want to check, make sure your 990s are up to date, because 2019 is the last one that's available to the federal government.
They are up to date, and we can provide that to you.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Igbaje, any final comments on the bill?
Thank you, Chair Howard. I just thank you for everyone's discussion today and everyone's testimony. I think we all realize how important public housing is, and so I look forward to more discussions on how this can be included in the final omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks to everyone who testified here today in the conversation. With that, I will renew Vice Chair Igbaje's motion that House File 2477 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And with that, the bill is laid over. And now the Vice Chair and I are going to switch spots here.
All right, well, the chair is moving down. I will go ahead and move that the bill, House File 2335, now be in front of the committee for a motion for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Is that so moved? Is that your motion?
That is my motion, Vice Chair.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Please present your bill.
Chair Igbaje, members, this is the governor's housing budget bill, and I'll be brief because we are going to run short on time. But what I want to say overall is that I am so appreciative of the governor for his budget, and appreciative of Commissioner Ho and Minnesota Housing for presenting a budget that really aligns with the values that I think that this committee has talked about. We've heard elements of this budget all throughout session, and so I think we'll hear a lot about alignment of those values. And I'm just very grateful for the partnership and the opportunity for the governor's housing budget and for the commissioner to be here to present it.
Thank you, Commissioner Ho. Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
It's going to be very confusing for me, Chair and Chair. I am Chair Onemije and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Ho, and I'm the commissioner at Minnesota Housing. And in the interest of time, I had spoken with Chair Howard, grateful for his carrying this bill, but we thought that it makes the most sense to focus today on the parts of the bill that are parts that haven't received a lot of hearing time because of individual bills that are going along, but we'd be happy to answer any questions along the way that you might like. That said, I'd like to start by just reminding folks that the way that we put the budget together was to be responsive
really with what I consider lots of ands. There's lots of ands in this budget proposal. We can do rental and home ownership. We can do new construction and preservation. We can do deeply affordable housing as well as market rate housing. We can do homelessness prevention and home ownership development. We can do rental assistance and down payment assistance. And so the budget allows us to attend to the broad range of housing needs in the state. Just to remind folks on the budget side, not the bonding side, we have a fiscal year 24-25 recommendation that totals to $842 million across four major categories, which is how we divide up what we do in partnership with the legislature. And I did include for you, so that you would just have them handy, slides that cover the full budget in terms of the various line items for each of these four areas. The ones that I really want to highlight today are the Economic Development and Housing Challenge Program, Workforce and Affordable Home Ownership, Strengthening Supportive Housing, Homework Starts with Home, and the agency's First Generation Down Payment Assistance Program. So to begin with the challenge program, as I've mentioned to the committee before, this is the number one source of state appropriated dollars for new housing in the state. It allows us to do deferred loans and grants to both for-profit and nonprofit developers, as well as local units of government. And what I really love about the challenge program is it gives the agency the flexibility to be responsive to what communities say that they need. Communities bring proposals forward, and again, it allows us to cover a broad range of different types of housing. We know that this is absolutely critical for economic growth and job creation around the state. I hear from businesses and local electeds across the state that that as they struggle to hire workers, the lack of affordable homes is one of the biggest challenges that they have. And so this allows us to really partner to create new housing that's really targeted to low and moderate income homeowners, home buyers, as well as renters. You know, in the past, we have always received more requests for this funding than we had funding available. We believe that $100 million of infusion into this will allow us to fund development across the state and help us get caught up where we have been quite behind. I just want to highlight for a moment the photograph in this slide. You may ask yourself, as I did of staff yesterday, why is there a photograph of a garage? It's really important for the family that lives in this home. This photo is a slide from a new construction project that was completed in Moorhead by the Cass Clay Community Land Trust that received challenge funding in 2020. It was a partnership with their local Habitat for Humanity affiliate. The family who lives here has four children, including a daughter who uses a wheelchair. So finding an accessible home large enough for the family was a real struggle for that family. This home meets the family's needs, and with down payment assistance, they were able to purchase the home. And the land is in the land trust, so it will be permanently affordable. So you can see just in the photograph, one, the garage is big enough for the van that also has the ability to transport the wheelchair. It's got a flat accessibility entrance into the doorway. So these are the types of things that the Economic Development and Housing Challenge Program can do. We're estimating about 1,200 additional housing opportunities could be done with this infusion into the challenge program. And again, that's a combination of multifamily new construction, single-family construction, as well as the other uses for the program. I love the challenge program. I think I've said that before, but I just think if there's one thing, this is a great program because it allows us to be responsive to local community needs. The second program that I want to talk about today is our workforce and affordable home ownership program. By infusing $30 million into this program, it would take it from a program that's simply $500,000 in per biennium today to something that really could be responsive to what we're hearing from communities across the state. This really allows us to increase the supply of homes for sale all across the state. Again, partnerships with cities, tribes, nonprofits, cooperatives, community land trusts. We can use the money for development costs, rehab, land acquisition, as well as manufactured home park infrastructure. And again, you know, this is kind of a little engine that could at $250 million a year. Imagine what we could do if we infused $30 million into it. It would go out through a competitive process.
It would cover kind of the costs associated with homeownership projects. This is something where in a rising interest rate environment, a rising construction cost environment, this really makes it possible to do single family home construction in smaller communities across the state. I just think that this is something that in this economic environment with so much need, this is an opportunity for us really to do an infusion in new construction for home ownership, something that I know that we've talked a lot about, the need to address the supply side of things. Since 1996, I personally have been working on how do we finance the support that makes supportive housing. And I will tell you that we still haven't quite gotten it right. And even though we have thousands of units of supportive housing across the state, even though we have proven time and time again that supportive housing can not only break the cycle of homelessness, even for people who have been homeless the longest with the most severe impairments that are either a result of their homelessness or caused their homelessness. Even though we have proven time and time again that it's actually more cost-effective to taxpayers for somebody to be stably housed than for them to be cycling through crisis and institutional services and not getting any better, we still have not figured out how to tell those developers of supportive housing, you have a reliable, consistent, and adequate source of service funding that's going to allow you to operate that project into perpetuity. I have always deeply believed that with so many people that move into supportive housing, they're poor, they're now eligible for Medicaid, they have health conditions, that there needs to be a bridge to the medical assistance program for people to be able to get their health and behavioral health needs met after they have moved into supportive housing, but we really haven't been able to build that solid bridge to the healthcare system. With strengthening the supportive housing, we're proposing to do $40 million of one-time money in order to shore up the supportive housing providers that are there today and create incentives for the continued construction of supportive housing as a proven intervention to long-term homelessness, as well as create incentives in partnership with our friends at the Department of Human Services to create a bridge into the healthcare system so that the healthcare system can take responsibility for meeting the healthcare needs and providing the supports that allow people to remain stably housed. So this is something that I just believe is long overdue. We've been creating supportive housing through the agency and in communities across Minnesota since the mid-1990s. And we just haven't quite finished getting it right. This is an opportunity for us to get that right. I want to talk just briefly about Homework Starts with Home. We know that housing stability eliminates school mobility, and that a child who can stay in the same school from the beginning of the year till the end of the year and into their next school year can get a better education, do better at school, as well as form lasting attachments with friends and their neighbors. Homework Starts with Home. The median income of the households that were assisted last year was $16,800. So these are very, very low income families. A quarter of the households included a head of household who had a disability. One in five of the families helped had experienced long-term homelessness. They've been homeless for a year or longer or repeatedly. And what we know is that if we can stabilize these kids, that it's going to have a lasting impact throughout their life. With an addition of $5 million to Homework Starts with Home, we would have a priority for new funding to serve younger children, pre-K kids, starting from pregnant moms and all the way through until kids go to school. A child who is born into homelessness is at such a disadvantage for the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. Their risk of becoming repeatedly homeless or homeless as an adult, as well as being behind in school and therefore disadvantaged in the job market when they're adults. We just know that the earlier we can intervene, the better. There's an estimated 5,000 young children that aren't yet in school who we believe are at risk of or experiencing homelessness today. And there are tragically between 500 and 1,000 infants who are born into homelessness every year. I just want to tell a quick story about a mom who had a disability who experienced homelessness in a shelter, temporarily housed in one small room with her two children. After she was accepted into the Homework Starts with Home program, her case manager assisted her with housing search and they located an apartment. She then started attending her own physical and mental health appointments and found a primary care provider and specialist for her severely disabled child. As a result, the mom was approved for Social Security disability, the two kids maintained regular school attendance, and they had a son who graduated from high school and joined the National Guard. The mom reports that her children's mental health and overall well-being have greatly improved. So this is about a $7,000 household subsidy per family, but I think the returns are priceless. I wanted to talk about the agencies. This is the last piece I want to hit, down payment and closing cost assistance program. Our proposal is to put $100 million into a first generation down payment assistance program. I think that one of the things I think I really want to emphasize is this is the core of what my agency does. We did over $1 billion in mortgages for home buyers last year. That's 5,000 people that we helped buy a home, most of whom were first-time home buyers. Across the agency's 5,000 mortgages that our network helped us do last year, 40% of those mortgages went to households of color. That is almost twice what the rest of the industry standard is in the state of 21%. So we are leading the mortgage market in Minnesota with the effectiveness of our programs and our partners doing lending to households of color. We have won awards across the country. We're distinguished across housing finance agencies for our work in this space. And we really are an industry leader in the state, demonstrating that whether you're a big bank or a small bank, that you can do this. It just requires intentionality of the effort. So, as I said, about 40% of our mortgages go to households of color. When you take a look at the down payment assistance that the agency does today that's the most targeted to lower income, larger families, families with a disability, two-thirds of the mortgages in our down payment loan plus down payment assistance program line are households of color. So, we think that building on the track record that the agency has done doing lending in this space, as well as working in partnership with other communities to bring other entities along to be able to help achieve this goal, will really help us make a big difference in terms of closing the homeownership gap in Minnesota. That's the rest of my slides. I'm trying to get you back on time here today, chairs, and happy to take any questions. And as always, I'd like to leave you with Dan's contact information in case you have any hard questions.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. I will open to the public if there's any members of the public that want to testify. Doesn't look like it, so we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Johnson.
Representative Abadji, Chair Howard, I take it this bill is can be laid over. Okay, with that, because of time, I think I'll ask if the commissioner would come back when we actually take this bill up again for questions, if it's possible, and we'll just lay the bill on the table for now so we can try to get caught up on our time.
Commissioner Ho?
Chair, Representative, happily.
Thank you.
And also, if I may, I just want to acknowledge that we have a lot of supporters in the room today. So I just want to acknowledge them. We don't get to be with folks in person. It's fun to be back here with folks.
Thank you. We're glad to see supporters in the room. So that's great. Any other member questions? All right. Seeing none, closing comments. Chair Howard, I remember this time.
Thank you, Chair Abadji. I will just leave us with, again, my gratitude to the commissioner, to Minnesota Housing, to the work to come. We will be putting together an omnibus bill. I look forward to that bill having a lot of alignment and for us to ultimately meet these objectives by the end of the session together. and making historic investments across the continuum of housing and really responding to the most pressing needs. I think we're up to the challenge and look forward to it.
I like the use of the word challenge. So.
Thank you, Representative Howard and Chair Howard. I will motion again that House File 2335 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and this bill is laid over. Representative Kozlowski, to your bill.
Representative Kozlowski and Mr. Kitzberger, I think we bumped you twice now for this bill. So here you are. We are a captive audience and ready. So I will move that we lay House File 1874 over for possible inclusion into an omnibus bill, and we'll turn it to Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. If I were a rapper, I'm like Maria Issa, I might, say, guess who's back?
Yeah.
but in all seriousness, glad to be here in supporting yet another agency bill with Minnesota Housing. This is House File 1874. It's a policy and technical bill that the agency brings forward each year. So the agency administers programs and works with partners, and there are issues that come up, and it's important that we continue to make these changes to improve access and provide clarity to the existing programs while expanding program eligibility where we can, and continue to help with the historic levels of need and funding has been described today that's being deployed all across the state. So I will turn it over to Minnesota Housing, Dan Kitzberger.
Mr. Kitzberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, I'm Dan Kitzberger. I'm the legislative director at the agency, and I'll try to move through this relatively quickly just to be sensitive of time and of course, be happy to answer any questions that might come up. So the bill is, again, as stated, it's a number of provisions we've been that are more technical in nature, just help things function more efficiently and clarify parts of language, and also hopefully even create a little bit of savings, and I can talk a little bit more about that. So Article 1, Section 1, that has to do with the agency's debt ceiling on outstanding notes and debts. It's just to clarify that it applies only to general obligation bonds that carry a general obligation pledge of the agency. Again, we're a discrete component unit of the state, so this does not have to do with the general obligation bonds that we have authorization from you, the legislature. These are typically mortgage revenue bonds that we are collecting revenues from mortgage holders on in order to pay the debt service on them. So again, this is where the bonds carry a general obligation pledge from the agency, which is separate from the state's general obligation pledge. Sections 2 through 6 create authority, not a requirement, but authority for us to work with Minnesota Management and Budget to embark on a process that's called refunding bonds. Refunding bonds is the term used in federal tax law. You can also think of it as refinancing bonds. So it allows for us, if conditions are right, in a what you would think of as a favorable interest rate environment, probably not now, but hopefully years from now, where we have series of bonds outstanding, where the bonds would be paid and replaced with a set of bonds at a lower interest rate, hopefully producing a savings on debt service. The idea is not to take on additional debt service within those bonds. It's simply to pay off and hopefully produce an interest rate savings. And so when conditions are right between us in consultation with Minnesota Management and Budget, we would embark on that process. And so the language as you see it would apply to both nonprofit housing bonds, which are kind of the older cousin, perhaps, if you will, of housing infrastructure bonds, and then housing infrastructure bonds themselves, which is what we've been issuing in that area since about 2012. So brings us to, so that's sections 2 through 6 in Article 1. Article 2 has to do with clarifying eligibility and uses for programs. So section 1 allows for the preservation and addition of an accessory dwelling unit with our rehab loan program, our fix-up fund, as we call it at the agency. And this is really just to kind of recognize that this is another housing option for, you know, multi-generational families to allow folks to age in place. So we wanted to allow that as an eligible use under that program. Section 2 would actually create a new subdivision in our enabling statute. So right now, we kind of do piecemeal tribal eligibility among our different program statutes. This would ensure and clarify that tribal nations are eligible recipients of all of our appropriated grant programs. Section 3 would create a requirement in our enacting statute and create a new subdivision that we would prioritize funds for serving households most impacted by housing disparities. Section 4 would allow us or give us authority to create a special purpose credit program. So right now, under federal law, you have to have explicit authorization in state statute in order to do this. And so this would be one way at which we could further target racial disparities in home ownership, in particular, in lending programs. Section 5 has to do with the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program. So it would eliminate the need for a resolution of support from county boards when applying for a grant through the program. So the program is now actually 30 years old. It was founded in 1993. And this was really a provision to build familiarity and in some cases support for the idea. You know, this program often works in concert with emergency assistance, which is administered at the county level. And so the idea here was to help county boards better understand, you know, the uses, the need for the program. But in some cases, it's actually become a little bit of a hurdle now that, you know, counties are familiar with it and have come to rely on it as a critical source of support. You know, there are jurisdictions in greater Minnesota where a grant administrator is serving, you know, in some cases up to 7 counties, and so it can just become a burden in order to get that done during the grant application process. So in Section 6, this has to do with housing infrastructure bonds. This would strike some language that was included a couple years ago that goes along with the use for new single-family development. But we actually have authority in statute, in that same statute, the clause right next to it, or clause F, paragraph 4, that allows for that use to issue the type of debt we need to finance home ownership developments. So we just want to take that language out. It's kind of created some confusion since it was put in. And just to be abundantly clear, the single family use for housing infrastructure bonds will remain. And then the next part of Section 6, dealing with housing infrastructure bonds in Article 2, clarifies the definition of senior and senior households. Again, the language that created that make sure that we're considering the income of everybody living in the senior household. Section 7 also has to do with housing infrastructure bonds. So this would allow for grants for housing infrastructure bonds for federally assisted rental housing to replace it. So we've encountered a few potential projects, particularly in greater Minnesota, in housing operated by local public housing authorities. And they may be, you know, separate buildings as part of a single development. And there are some that have fallen into a state of disrepair to the point where it makes more sense fiscally to just replace it. And so that's what we're proposing to do here to allow for that. And then we're also proposing to strike some language that would require service plans as part of senior housing. This has been kind of difficult to operationalize, and the senior housing that we're building with housing infrastructure bonds really isn't the type of folks that we're looking to house and are eligible for that. Typically, aren't in need of service on a regular basis. Section 8 has to do with the workforce housing development program. Again, this is Article 2, Section 8. We want to make counties eligible applicants. Right now, they aren't eligible. And we've had a situation recently where, you know, a county established a land trust program or a land trust and has applied for the program. And actually, you know, we've seen this here in recent years where counties want to play a more active role in, you know, not just promoting housing in their communities, but actually being able to apply for some available funding to be able to do that, which we think is really exciting. Section 9 is also the workforce housing development program. I want to clarify that applications can come from only outside the 7-county metro area. That's how we've interpreted it, but we just want to make it abundantly clear in statute that's the case. And then we also want to amend the definition of eligible project area that would include tribes and cities on tribal reservations as eligible applicants, since they currently aren't. It's only cities and other local units of government, such as economic development authorities, that can apply. Section 10, also the workforce housing development program, want to make tribes and tribal nations eligible matching entities, since they aren't currently. And then section 7 would just adjust some of our language in an appropriation rider to again clarify the replacement of federally assisted housing under that particular program. So I think that's it as far as what the bill does, and I can try to answer any questions that members might have.
Are there questions for members? Representative Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Grump. The only concern I have is on line 1.15. Years ago, this legislative body was smart enough when it created Minnesota Housing Finance to put a debt limit of loans and bonds and all bonds at a certain level. Because without that debt limit, we could find ourselves in a serious situation. I don't know where we are on that debt limit right now, but I'm concerned about changing it until we have information. I've actually already requested the information from MMB, and hopefully be getting it shortly. Chair Howard, is this bill going to be laid on the table, or is this moving forward?
This will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay. I will end it there. And like I say, I have concerns. I want to make sure that we don't get ourselves into this body allows Minnesota Housing Finance get this body into trouble. Because even though the statute says we are not responsible for the debt that they do, ultimately we are. So I just want to make sure we're fiscally responsible.
I'll go to either Representative Kozlowski or Mr. Kitzberger to either respond to that or to make any final comments.
A brief response, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson. We can get you the information on where we're standing on outstanding debt currently. We're not particularly close. This debt limit was contemplated prior to the creation of housing infrastructure bonds, for example. That might be the fastest growing part of our outstanding notes and debts, but by far the largest amount is in mortgage revenue bonds that we do our single family lending through the proceeds.
With that, I will renew the motion that House File 1874 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And with that, the bill is laid over. All right, members, we got two Norris bills up, and then we'll close her out. First one is House File 2022. Representative Norris, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Chair Howard. I move House File 2022, and there's a DE1 amendment.
Would you care to move your DE amendment and briefly explain it?
Yes. So I moved the DE1 amendment. This essentially it deletes the whole bill and gets it into the shape that we intend, where this was a helpful vehicle that just happened to be sitting in the Housing Committee, and due to time constraints, we're going to use this to put on the tax credit language we're going to discuss today.
Any discussion? If not, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. I just want to make sure that we're changing the bill that was allowing for loans to people purchasing ones as well as a credit to now just dealing with a credit for the sellers of the park homes. Is that correct?
Representative Norris.
Chair Howard, Representative Petersburg, yes, that's correct. I believe that some of the other components that were in the bill have already been heard in some of our other manufactured housing packages.
All those in favor of the DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The DE1 is adopted. Representative Norris, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Howard. And as I mentioned, we've had a lot of different manufactured housing bills come before the committee this year, and Representative Feist and I have been having some great conversations with all the stakeholders on a lot of those components, and I think we're making progress on hopefully getting everybody together on a package we can all agree on. But this tax credit component is something that I think everybody can get behind. I want to, as you can see from the delete all amendment today, this legislation attempts to increase resident ownership of manufactured home communities through an incentive approach, an income tax credit for the sellers. My testifier, Mr. Hansen of the North Country Cooperative Foundation, will kind of go into greater detail about the bill, but really the purpose of this legislation is to preserve and expand affordable home ownership in the most cost-effective way possible, while also creating a win-win situation for the residents and the owners. It's estimated that this tax credit proposal could convert about 2 to 6 parks to resident ownership each year, which would preserve home ownership for hundreds of units and keep millions of dollars in the state. At the same time, it would cost the state less than, we're estimating, $1 million per year, and we are working on getting an official revenue estimate from the Department of Revenue ahead of our next stop in the Tax Committee. It's also worth noting that this legislation is supported by the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association. We'll actually be hearing from them shortly, in addition to some of our resident advocates. So in the interest of time, I'll turn it over to the testifiers.
First up, Joel Hansen, Advocacy Manager with North Country Cooperative.
Appreciate it, Chair Howard. Thank you, Representative Norris, for authoring this bill. Thank you, members of the committee. I will try to make this as quick as possible in interest of time. So as you can see on line 1.17, we have a 5% tax credit to a manufactured home park owner that sells their community to either a manufactured home park cooperative, a nonprofit organization that would be incorporated as a 317A, or a representative acting on behalf of residents, which is already defined in statute. So why 5%? So in Minnesota, the top state capital gain tax liability for a sale of a park would be about 9.85%. So a 5% income tax credit on the sale for the park owner would represent roughly a 50% cut in their capital gains liability. So that's how we arrived at 5%. And doing a tax credit this way is a lot more straightforward than trying to do anything with capital gains tax liability. So why the need for this incentive? Well, this legislation would incentivize park owners to sell to the residents, thereby serving two purposes. The first being the beneficiaries of the credit and the preserved units would keep all of this money in Minnesota, as opposed to it leaving and going out of state, having parks purchased by out-of-state speculators. Secondarily, this would lead to long-term affordable home ownership in an incredibly cost-effective way. What we've seen is cooperative ownership leads to long-term sustainable, affordable home ownership. So what's the cost? So we estimate this legislation could convert 2 to 6 parks, as Representative Noor said, present ownership a year. That would preserve hundreds of units of home ownership. There's a handout in your packets that has a chart and kind of just shows what we estimate what the cost would be. So as you can see from this chart, we're just using previous conversions of parks that we did. So in there, we have 275 units of home ownership that we converted. The cost on those, if we were just to have the tax credit for those, would be less than $330,000. So obviously, that's a cost per unit of home ownership of $1,200. So when we're talking about preserving affordable home ownership at low AMI levels, it's about the lowest we're going to see. As a comparison, 30% AMI preservation can cost upwards of $300,000 a unit. So that's where we're at this point. I'll stand for questions.
Thank you. I think we'll go to our next testifier. Perfect. We'll ask you to come back if there's questions.
Thank you.
We have Mark Bruner with the Minnesota Manufacturing Modular Home Association. Mr. Bruner, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark Bruner, Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. And we represent the builders of manufactured modular homes in the state. There are 15 plants, as well as the owners of manufactured home communities, or at least the privately owned. There are about 1,000 of them with 50,000 home sites. And we are the state's largest source of non-subsidized affordable housing. Although we'll be talking about homes in manufactured home communities today, about 85% of the new homes we build go on private property with conventional type mortgages, basements, garages, and foundations. I'd like to thank Representative for bringing the bill and working with the industry and coming to an agreement. Essentially, what the bill would do is, as explained by the testifier, is provide an incentive for the owners of manufactured home communities to sell to their residents. It would allow residents to be more proactive, if you will, and perhaps approaching an owner and ask if they're interested in selling, and then be able to explain some of the incentives for them to sell to the residents versus a private party. So we're supportive of the bill, and thank again Representative North.
Are there questions for members? Representative Petersburg.
We're on the final bill now, right?
Yes.
Quick question for you. Has there been requested a fiscal note for this particular bill? And because I'm sure you're going to have one when it comes to the tax committee, because the testifier has already presented something that says we're looking at $390,000 a year. 2 years, that's close to $750,000 or a little over that. Do we know if we're going to get that or see that?
Representative Norris.
Chair Howard and Representative Petersburg, yes, we are working with the DOR. A revenue estimate has been requested. We expect it will be available before our hearing in tax. But, yeah, based on kind of the rough back-of-the-envelope math that you've got here, we're expecting that it will be about $1 million a year in terms of cost. But as Mr. Hansen outlined, you know, when you actually look at that on a per unit basis, it's, you know, about maybe $1,200 per unit. That's about as cost effectively as we can acquire or maintain our naturally occurring affordable housing.
Thank you, and Mr. Chair.
Yes, yeah, Mr. Petersburg.
And I would just echo, I think if my colleague, Mr. Representative Nash, would say, you know, again, we're dealing with something that we don't have a fiscal note for, and it would be nice to know what those finance costs are before we send it out of the committee, and I'll just echo that concern. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other members? I'll just thank you, Representative Norris. I know this sort of concept came up when we had the opportunity to purchase bill before us, and just appreciate your continued work and conversations holistically on these issues this session. Any final comments?
Chair Howard, I'll just reiterate that. I think we've been having some great discussions on a number of issues. This is one that everybody can get behind, and I'm hopeful that this can be the linchpin to a broader deal that is going to help our residents and make sure that we're maintaining naturally occurring affordable housing here in the state of Minnesota while also doing right by the owners.
With that, I will renew the motion that House File 2022 as amended be re-referred to the House Taxes Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the bill is on its way to taxes. Thank you, Representative Norris. You can stay up there because you have our last bill of the day, which is House Bill 2492. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Chair Howard. I will now move House File 2492.
The bill is before us. The motion will be to re-refer this to the House Education Finance Committee. And I will go to you, Representative Norris, to present your bill.
Thank you. So this bill, House File 2492, is about creating a triple win. The last bill was a win-win, a win for the residents, a win for the park owners. This is a triple win. We're reducing homelessness, we're building construction skills in our young people, and we're promoting home ownership. There's a lot of fantastic programs at schools throughout the state of Minnesota that teach the students construction skills, and as part of that learning experience, they actually build housing, and that can take a number of different forms. Sometimes it's tiny houses. Sometimes you see it's actually full-fledged stick-built housing, single-family homes. But it's as I said, a triple win. You're building construction skills and getting young people interested in the trades. Providing very affordable housing, and you're promoting home ownership for our neighbors across Minnesota who need it. So the way this bill promotes that is by making school districts eligible to apply to the Challenge Program for grant funding. They could apply for up to $100,000, and that would allow schools to either expand an existing program or start a program like this of their own. And I've got a couple of testifiers who have a real in-depth experience with the program at various schools, and so I'm happy to invite them up and have them share a little bit about how this program works.
All right, our first testifier is Kalik Rogers of United for Action and Good Riddance LLC.
All right, good evening, Chair and Committee. Kalik Rogers, Good Riddance Consulting. Yeah, I just want to thank you for the opportunity, and as a whole, like, I've experienced homelessness myself. I'm coming from Chicago, being a Chicago native, transitioning as my family. It took a leap of faith for us to come to Minnesota just to find that the same disparities and marginalizations that were going on in the housing market was pretty much just the same. We ended up looking for housing for at least 5 months, and after expending a lot of our resources on housing applications and things of that nature, you know, the whole three times the rent market that we're in, we unfortunately weren't able to find housing, and we had to ultimately go into a shelter. But the shelter spaces only typically hold single family or single parent households, which caused my family to have to disperse because my father was there at the time, and that split our family. So I never forgot those experiences, and for me, going through my education experience, I also seen other youth that reminded me of myself in that process, that I could see in them that they also had or either were currently homeless or on the brink of that. And, you know, as a whole, we can, like, till today, there's about 7,000 youth that are homeless at any given night here in the state of Minnesota. And if you ask school districts, they can affirm that over a year, you can multiply those numbers by 2 to 3 times. So for me, I take a data-driven but human-centered approach to the work that I do on amplifying these needs of community. And I actually did research, and I have an article within MnPost on youth homelessness. And some of the things that the youth stated, because I went directly to that community, is that they don't feel safe in shelters. They would prefer permanent supportive housing rather than the options where they're just band-aid solutions to these issues. And for me, if we amend this law, this creates an opportunity for us to change the narrative so they can be a part of the change. Rather than being victims, they can be protagonists that change the narrative for themselves and future youth as well. So thank you, and let's continue to build together.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Next, we have Jill Stewart Keller from Intermediate School District 916. Welcome to the committee.
Thanks for having me. Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jill Stewart Keller, and I'm the proud Assistant Director of Career and Technical Education at Northeast Metro 916, an intermediate school district that serves the communities north and east of St. Paul. at the Northeast Metro 916 Intermediate School District, we serve over 1,000 students that are taking career and technical education classwork as a part of their traditional high school experience. Today, I'm here to strongly support 2492. With those 1,000 high school students, we're finding the skilled trades, and the pendulum has swung toward preparing students for post-secondary success in the skilled trades. Our construction occupations program that you see photos of in front of you today is bursting at the seams. We have more students than we can even have on our job site for our construction occupations program. However, our construction occupations program is only happening because of our partnership with the City of North St. Paul. We are actually very fortunate to have that partnership, because without the City of North St. Paul, there wouldn't be a house to build, because we don't have the funds to do so. What I see HF 2492 is really benefiting is providing home ownership and an opportunity for high school programs to be created to capture this interest of our youth to build their skills in the trades, discover a future in construction, and then also be able to give back to their community by being able to build homes in districts that do not have partnerships like the ones we have with the City of North St. Paul. Aside from that, of course, obviously the priority here is providing permanent affordable housing to people in our area at a very modest cost. When schools and districts, intermediate and independent alike, have access to these funds, we'll be able to provide more opportunities for schools to train our youth in construction skills, which we all know is an urgent need of workers, and also help the number of low-income people become those who own homes.
Thank you. Last, we have Joe Nathan, Center for School Change. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. In the interest of time, I'm going to spend less than a minute. You have in front of you the opportunity to get young people involved in helping to build homes. At the same time, for reasons that you've been hearing for the last 2 hours, there's an urgent need. So this meets, as Representative Norris said, immense needs. We have a representative from the west side of St. Paul. There's a fantastic program going on at the Guadalupe Area Project right now, literally about 8 minutes from this room, which you might want to go see, where high school youngsters are building homes right now for young people, for people who are low income. So last point on this is that new research has just come out here in Minnesota showing the difference between 20 and 50. And that difference is as follows. This is Minnesota research showing that the average youngster who is homeless has the same life expectancy as a person who is 50. So by increasing the stock of permanent affordable housing, you are increasing life expectancy for people by 30 years. Thank you very much for hearing this bill. We hope to work with you on it.
Thank you. Member discussion, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it sounds like a really good program. The issue that, not the issue, I am concerned, and maybe you could give me some more information, Representative Norris, on how the Grant Challenge Program is funded and how the grants are determined and awarded. Obviously, if this program is going to be beneficial, there needs enough money in there and so forth. And so do you have that information, or maybe somebody else does?
Representative Norris.
Chair Howard, Representative Petersburg. So the Challenge Grant Program is one of the largest grant programs at Minnesota Housing. I think it's probably, I don't have my materials with me, but I think it's in your packet in the appropriation bill we just looked at. I think it was maybe, what, like $75 million or something? It was a relatively large number.
I'll go to our nonpartisan staff.
The base appropriation for Housing Challenge under current law in the upcoming biennium is $25,850,000.
And I think that the bill we heard, the governor's budget, they're proposing to increase $100 million more than that. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you for that. And in the past, has there been more grants asked for than what were awarded?
I'm sure that Minnesota Housing could speak to this, but the short answer is very much so.
So that's one of the questions I ask is we haven't really made any special arrangements for school districts to get it, so there's likelihood that some schools may still apply for it and not get the grant. So I just food for thought, because I think that's important to know that when we set up a grant for schools, but there's enough money to actually fund it, that is going to make some difference too. Thank you.
Representative Norris on that.
Yeah, Chair Howard and Representative Petersburg, you make a great point. You're right. And intentionally, we didn't give any preferential treatment to the schools. The advocates had some really good conversations with Minnesota Housing. The original idea was to create kind of a separate approach. Minnesota Housing recommended that we fold it into the challenge program. So they'll compete with all the other applicants. If they've got a meritorious application, it'll be awarded. But there also is a separate pool of funding that's in a separate bill that's before the, I think, the Economic Development, either Economic Development or Workforce Development Committee, that's specifically for the Youth Build Program that kind of does a similar thing. So this is about, you know, providing some different options to make sure that our schools have the resources they need to hopefully get young people into these construction careers and provide some affordable housing for our Minnesota neighbors.
Representative Petersburg, that's a good argument for us to get a higher budget target. I hope they're listening upstairs. Thank you.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair Howard. I guess my question is there a financial literacy piece to this program in terms of mortgages?
Yes.
Representative Norris.
Chair Howard, Representative Cha, you read my mind or helped ask a nice leading question to highlight the fact that included in here, the homeowners are required to go through a home ownership education counseling and training program that is kind of administered by Minnesota Housing. So thank you for that.
Representative Cha?
Yes. Thanks for that, because, you know, we often talk about, you know, housing and stuff, but we forget the financial literacy of, you know, credit scores, mortgages, and 30 years is a long time for a young person to plan ahead, right? And so there's it's a huge undertaking. So I appreciate the answer and continue to chip away. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative. Thank you for bringing a good bill.
I'll take that, Representative.
There is a couple of things I'd like you to consider, though. With these schools, they get that first grant, they build a home, and they hopefully build a quality home. And I'm sure with the instructors and the other people helping them, they will. But then they can sell this home and use those funds to build another home or two. So I would suggest it would be a one-time grant for a school so we can get more schools involved. That way, I think it's important that we give an opportunity for our kids to learn a trade, whether it's plumbing, whether it's bricklaying, whether it's framing or carpentry, electrical work. It's important. We are begging for people to go in those fields. And you're showing, by doing this, you're also showing the importance that we need to look at what we did to our vote. Tech schools a number of years ago by taking them out of the high school oversight and putting them to our colleges. We need to get them back to the high school. Because our colleges, and I hope my president of my college, my community is not listening, but the college system has not done the technical schools any favors. They've been pushing to two and four-year college degrees. And we are in dire need of plumbers, electricians, or we won't have any homes to build. So I like this idea, and I think it can work. But like I said, consider going just once per school so we can get it to all the schools, get all those kids that are interested, give them let them know what it's like. So if they're interested, they go into a great field that doesn't put you in debt forever.
Representative Norris.
Chair Howard, Lee Johnson, you make a great point, and maybe some of the advocates might be able to elaborate further, but that is the model that most of the schools use. They produce the home, and then they sell it, and they can then recycle those dollars and build another one or two. So I think our idea is that this kind of can be seed money either for schools to start a new program or expand if they've got one program or a house. I'm sorry, a program that can build one house in place already, that if they've got the student interest, they can maybe expand to doing a second house per year.
Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, Representative Norris and also to the testifier in regards to, I know this program for many students at GAP is what we call it, Guadalupe Alternative Program, that's been championing with the work from the challenge. It gives these youth an opportunity to engage in growing out of the economic crisis that, you know, that is the reality in underserved communities. And these programs are the development and gives those kids a leap of faith in knowing that they can go somewhere and they have an option to choose. And it also gives them an opportunity to even grow into that field of work. When you plant the seed, you know, you see the outcome once it gets water, and this is the water to those seeds. Thank you.
Representative Norris, any final comments on the bill?
I just thank all the members for the strong support of this idea, and hopefully we can find some room in that target to include this, Chair Howard.
With that, I will renew our motion that House File 2492 be re-referred to the House Education Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Members, thanks for sticking with us. With that, we are adjourned.